Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're really going to talk about Alternative Visions here. I have a special guest who I will introduce shortly. You know, it's kind of important to look beyond the short term. Let me give you a little bit of an analogy here. You know, many years I was a union organizer for several unions, and quite successful. Won 80% of all my union elections, which is kind of rare nowadays, I think. Of course, that was a different time and a different place in America when people would still stand up and fight. Well, not to say they don't today, but it's certainly not as typical as it was in the 1970s. When I was around. And one thing I learned as an organizer, and I think one of the reasons for effectiveness, was that, you know, when I met with the workers and we first began talking about the whole process and what we had to do, it was important to describe to them the end game, where we were going to get to. And then, of course, how we were going to get there. But the tactics and the strategy, as important as they were, it was the vision that was equally important. People had to believe, workers have to believe that there's something better at the end of the road. You just don't try to get rid of what you got without describing, you know, what the end game is. That proved very effective. It was also important to tell them as we engaged in certain strategies and tactics in the election, in the organizing drive, what the employer would do each time and what our response would be, so that when the employer pulled off his tricks, they were less effective because people knew what they were and what was coming and how they would respond to them. So this ultimate vision, call it utopia, call it what you want, is extremely important when you're trying to politically mobilize people. Well, my guest today is going to talk about his vision, one of the few out there that's really trying to define the vision. Of course, you know, there's a little danger in that because you're not always maybe talking about reality in the present, and folks are a little bit reticent about, you know, pictures of the future. But by and large, overwhelmingly, I think creating a picture of the future is extremely important. Of course, that future today is called, as it has been for centuries, is called socialism. What does socialism mean? Well, there's many varieties of it and many meanings of it. You know, today, particularly workers under 35 years of age, majority of them now in polls say they're for socialism. Well, you know, in most cases, that kind of means nothing but the present. They know it's not working for them. And socialism is the alternative. They haven't defined it yet. But our guest is helping in that task to define it. I'm going to introduce him very, very shortly here. But I want to say before we do a couple things about news of the week, as I typically do. You know, the two most important developments this past week was Trump throwing in the towel and agreeing with China on this phase one mini trade deal. I had been predicting that Trump would do that. Before December 15th, another $160 billion in U.S. tariffs on China imports took effect because of growing discontent in his farm sector. China's just not buying the farm goods. 12,000 foreclosures of farmers going on, and most of the Trump $28 billion subsidies have been shown to go to big agribusiness. And the election's coming up, and he needs that that base. So I had predicted that he would not impose the $160 billion tariffs, that he would probably suspend them. Well, he went one step further. He caved in even more, and he indicated here that there would be no $160 billion on mostly China consumer goods imports, you know, which really would have hit average households. And he went even further, and he indicated that on another $120 billion of imports that already had tariffs of 15%, he would reduce them by half to 7.5%. He would keep 25% tariffs on $250 billion still. So he really caved in on the tariff question. Of course, he exaggerated and jumped ahead, as he typically does, and says, oh, the Chinese are going to buy $50 billion of tariffs. Well, this morning, Reuters clarified that China said the number is undetermined yet, and exactly when they'll buy the farm goods is still not determined. So Trump, as I predicted, would exaggerate and lie about the deal, and of course he's already doing that. But the big point is the tariffs, which have been China's position. You have to reduce the tariffs if you want to deal with us. Trump caved in on that. Politics took precedent because Trump's neocon military industrial complex faction led by Navarro and Lighthizer did not want a deal without China conceding on tech issues, next generation tech issues. We talked about that many times here. Well, it looks like the tech issues are off the table and maybe a phase two, but nothing else will happen on this thing. The trade war with China is over. Pretty much. And of course, the rest of the trade war with other countries was always been a farce, including NAFTA. Very little change there. So that's where we are with the China trade deal. The other thing I want to say a brief thing about is Brexit. The vote on Brexit, which was overwhelming yesterday. Boris Johnson, conservative, echo of Donald Trump in the UK. One overwhelming victory here in the parliamentary elections, and Labour, a massive defeat, the worst since defeat, the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn, the worst defeat since 1935 for them. So what's really behind this is very important. I wrote a piece, check it out on my blog, jackrasmus.com, about that. It will appear on other blogs shortly, I presume, here later today, if not already. And there are short-term tactical reasons. Johnson clearly outmaneuvered Labour and Corbyn. But there's longer-term factors here as well, the rise of nationalism and the ability to split the working class votes on nationalist appeal. And, of course, nationalism in Scotland. Now, Scotland will certainly vote to leave the United Kingdom at some point here again. So nationalism is upheaving UK politics just as it is US politics. And nationalist appeals are all part of clever capitalists as the global and national economies slow down and enter unstable conditions here. To manipulate the nationalist appeal to maintain power. And that's what's really going on, not just in the US, UK, other places in Europe, in the Philippines, in India, and so forth. That's the big play behind the longer term, behind the strategic and tactical errors of Labour in this election. But it's also an indication of the fading and decline of a classical, traditional European social democracy. Everywhere, it's in decline, and that's a long-term trend that has to do with these parties, social democratic parties, aligning themselves with neoliberal policies in recent decades, and now they're paying the price for that. People don't trust them anymore. So that's my comment on two of the important developments of the past week, Brexit. And do read my blog, jackerasmus.com, for deeper analyses of both of those developments. But I want to get back to my guest. My guest is a well-known writer and participant in progressive politics for decades here, well-respected and known for his attempt to get the progressives on the left to think about the vision of the future. As I indicated with my metaphor about union organizing, I think that's extremely important. Of course, he's doing it on a broader political scale, which is extremely important too, as more and more people get discontent with the conditions that American capitalism is creating for them. And most of the folks, the millennials, are indentured to a lifetime of economic hopelessness as far as where we're going. And as I've been writing, it's going to get worse. We have another big crisis around the corner in the early 2020s. And the conditions that exist now will get significantly worse because of new developments coming that will destroy jobs and incomes even more, like artificial intelligence and Uber gig economy and the Amazon effect, as I call it. All of these developments are going to occur with a vengeance here in the next decade. And if we think precarious work is a terrible situation in the U.S. now, just wait. And the interest in an alternative is going to grow. By the way, I don't believe capitalism will solve the climate crisis either. And thirdly, we got a massive increase in debt, corporate debt, household debt, government debt everywhere that's going to come home to roost here in the next decade. So for all those reasons, it's going to get worse. And for all those same reasons, interest in socialism is going to grow. And it's increasingly important to define that clearly and progressively. And that's just what our guest, Michael Albert, has been doing. And I want to have a discussion with Michael because I think it's extremely important what he's doing and how we define the future. Where are we going to go? You know, workers aren't fools. And if you want them to step out and take some risk and fight, well, you better be pretty clear on how you're going to do it. And pretty clear about, you know, what's the end result you're trying to get. And Michael, are you there?
I am.
Okay. Michael, jump off wherever you think it's relevant and, you know, tell us, you know, why the work you're doing you think is important and you know, define what you think socialism is all about.
Well, I think it's important. Basically, for the reasons you gave, if you don't know where you're going, I'm hearing an echo. Is that a problem?
Yeah, you're echoing a little bit. I'm not sure why.
Well, I'm talking on a telephone instead of anything else.
Well, maybe you got a PC speaker that's interfering.
That. Maybe we're okay now.
Are we okay?
I don't know.
Go ahead.
So let's try again. All right. Anyway, the reasons why it's important. Well, you know, look, if you don't know where you're going, you're likely to wind up someplace other than where you want to be. So that's one reason. You need to know what you're trying to achieve in order to orient your activities to take you where you want to go. And another reason is because a tremendous impediment to activity nowadays and activism, even though there's a lot going on in many audiences, an impediment to that is a lack of hope, a feeling that there really is no alternative. You can fight for, you know, higher wages or affirmative action or various improvements regarding, say, climate. You can fight for these things, but there's no alternative system. Modest changes, modest alterations on top of something that persists. And in the absence of thinking that the thing that we endure daily can be changed, there's not a lot of hope, drive, momentum, motivation. So you need it for motivation, you need it for hope, and you need it for direction. Or so it seems to me, anyway. And maybe I'll try and make one or two of those points clear as we go along more concretely. And the other question you asked is, well, what is it? What is this thing called socialism? Well, first, I think we're going to talk mostly about economics, but I do want to say that I think that a vision for society is not just economics. It's also about politics, or the way we arrange legislation and adjudication and executive actions. It's about kinship and family and sexual relations. It's about culture and race. But I think we're talking about economics today, so unless you ask otherwise, I'll stick with that.
Michael, if I may interject, you're absolutely right. It's more than economics, and feel free to give us the full picture.
Well, it's hard. I don't know how long I have. Let me start with economics then.
We got 45 minutes left on the show.
Okay, let me start with economics. The thing that has been called socialism for a long time, you can append that label to it, but if you do, then I would have to come up with a new label for what I like. Reason being that the thing that has been called socialism, in other words, the thing that has been implemented, say, in the Soviet Union or in China, in various places in the past, has not been an economy which eliminates class. It has not been an economy which delivers to economic actors, workers and consumers, control over their own lives. It has been an economy instead, I believe, which has gotten rid of the old boss, the owners, but introduced a new boss, or elevated a new boss. And that, to me, is not very inspiring in the way of a vision. And I think that's true for the American working class in particular. I think in this country, let's call it class antagonism. Antagonism by workers toward another class is actually not directed to any great degree, and especially to any sort of powerful emotional degree, toward owners. And the reason is because workers virtually never encounter an owner. They don't spend day to day being pushed around, bossed around, made to feel undignified, made to follow orders by owners. They don't encounter them, at least not in the large part of the economy. Instead, they encounter managers, doctors, engineers, lawyers, this other sector of people. I want to call them a coordinator class. And this other sector of people is where I think a great deal of class tension, class anger, class antagonism exists for working people. I actually think this is very relevant to the present. I think it's how Trump beat Clinton. Not that Clinton is anything to write home about. She's horrendous. But I think that oftentimes the right has succeeded in capturing way more votes among working people than it should, by appealing to their anger toward and their antagonism toward a class elitism that is not the owning class, but instead this coordinator class. So anyway, the point of this little sidebar is that if the vision that we present feels like what workers sort of most worry about suffering, which is that professionals, doctors, lawyers, engineers, managers, people who treat them as paternalistically or authoritatively are going to run the show, well, that's not something that working people, by and large, are going to devote themselves to trying to win. And that's what socialism has been. That is, the thing called socialism in practice has typically elevated that group of people, that class of people, to a ruling position. And what characterizes this group of people? Well, it's that the work that they do, unlike the work that what I'm going to call the working class does, empowers them. The work, the tasks that they do each day convey to them information and skills and connections to other people in the workplace, knowledge, access to decision-making, whereas other people in the workplace, the working class, and the working class is about 80% of the workplace, and the coordinator class about 20%, roughly speaking. The other group, the working class, does tasks which do not empower them. do not give them skills relevant to decision-making, tasks which do not increase their knowledge, create connections among them so that they can interact together and come up with what they desire and act on its behalf. And so what you have is a situation where something about the workplace causes that division and elevates the one group and not the other. And the thing about the workplace that is, I think, is the form of the division of labor that we have. You have to have a division of labor. You can't have everybody doing everything. That's impossible. But you don't have to give 20% of the workforce all the empowering tasks and 80% of the workforce only disempowering tasks so that the 20% dominate the 80%. You don't have to do that. But what has been called socialism has done that. So a key step, I suppose you could say, in coming up with a vision which has the potential to inspire and the potential to induce hope and also to instruct how we behave in the present so that we don't fall sway to that class division, we'll have to get rid of that class division. Another thing that it will have to do, not only to save the planet, but to save people, is to get beyond either authoritarian central planning or competitive markets, which create a situation in which everybody is out for themselves, everybody is pursuing advantage, and the social good is left by the side of the road while that's going on as a result of markets. So a new economic system has to deal with that. And the other thing that an economic system has to do is it has to convey to people control over their lives. It has to, as of now, inside of a big corporation, working people have less power inside that corporation than they typically do in a dictatorship in the rest of their lives. So they have no say over what they're producing, over how they're producing it, over the schedule that they're operating under. Oftentimes they have to ask permission to go to the bathroom. They have a degree of subordination that's astounding, but it's so familiar that it's just taken for granted. But that doesn't have to be the case. It could be the case that workers and consumers decide their own circumstances. So that's the other thing that a real, I think, what we might call participatory socialism or participatory economics or whatever you want to call it, a desirable vision for the economy would deliver to people an end to the class division between coordinators and workers, an end to allocation in a manner which is ecologically and personally and socially destructive, and control over their lives. And so that's the vision that I favor, does those things with some very simple institutions. And then I'll take a break here for you to interject. The institutions are workers' and consumers' councils. Why do you need them? That's basically places where workers and consumers can assemble, develop their positions, and advocate for them. Well, you need that if workers and consumers are going to make decisions. There has to be a place where they do that, and it's called workers and consumers councils. You need a division of labor. Not everybody can do everything. But if you're going to not have 20% lording it over 80%, then what you have to do is change the way you compose jobs. A job has to be a combination of tasks where some of those tasks are disempowering, but some are empowering. So we all do a job which has a mix of responsibilities and tasks such that each of us is comparably empowered by our workday. You don't have people who do only empowering in uplifting tasks. You have people who do a mix of tasks, and that's true across the economy. And finally, you have to replace markets and or central planning with a new approach to allocation. And in this particular vision of participatory socialism, that's called participatory planning. And it's a process by which workers and consumers councils sort of collectively negotiate societies' production and its allocation of that production among consumers and workplaces. And this vision, which of course needs to be spelled out and has been in many places, spelled out in a bit greater detail, can actually deliver to people self-management and real equity and real solidarity rather than a kind of a rat race, and classlessness in which all people have dignity and control over their lives. And that, I think, can be valuable both in generating hope, but also because it attunes us to various things that are critical and that are often not thought about. So, for instance, although changing the division of labor entirely is in the future, addressing it can be in the present. Addressing the allocation of tasks can be in the present. And although attaining real equity, I guess I didn't talk about that too much, income should be determined by, in this kind of an approach, how much work you do, how long you work, how hard you work, and the onerousness of the conditions under the work, your true work. You shouldn't get income because you have special talents that you were born with, or because you use wonderful equipment, or certainly not because you own property, which disappears, that idea. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's what participatory socialism means to be, and I think the way it can inform current tactics and strategy is by helping to pinpoint the things which have to be attained, and therefore steps in the present which move toward attaining those things.
Well, let me interject. In some ways, I agree with you. In some ways, I'm not so sure I do. You're certainly correct in identifying how different segments of class or whatever are pitted against each other now. And certainly there is, I would agree, resentment and some opposition between what you call the coordinator class and the working class. But I don't hear in your description the role of the 1% at the very top who really pull all the strings and are really behind pitting people against each other, which, of course, fragments and destroys the whole idea of class. I've been a critic for a long time of what's called identity politics. I think this is not by accident that what we hear in the U.S. and read and are exposed to are groups, sworn groups against each other, whether they're ethnic groups or racial groups or, generation groups, gender groups, whatever. This is all, I believe, a conscious effort by the two wings of the corporate party of America, especially the Democrats, to create divisions. You know, everything seems to be a matter of identity. And
all right. Well, let me.
That's a problem I see. And of course, as far as class consciousness is concerned, that's a problem. Okay. And I think, you know, your coordinator class is an element of that. But I don't hear the 1%, you know, that are really behind the ideologies and the programs and the policies and everything that are really responsible for the material and cultural crisis in this country right now.
Yeah, sure. The reason that I didn't talk about that is because I took for granted that you talk about it. Of course, the owners are no longer owners. That is to say, there is no private ownership of productive assets. So the 1% that you're talking about whose wealth and power is a function of owning means of production no longer own means of production. In fact, nobody does. So in this model, they no longer exist as a class. That's gone. So I was just taking that for granted. And perhaps that was a mistake. But my point was that even if we do that, it doesn't mean we have transcended having classes. And here's where I disagree with the rest of what you were just saying. I don't think that the antagonism, let's call it, between workers and managers, workers often in doctors, workers often in lawyers, workers often in engineers, is created, manufactured, is a thing that is unreal. I think it's quite real. I think that the position that what I'm calling the coordinator class holds in society, in the economy, is above, way above, working people. And that the antagonism in there is real, because the coordinator class sort of justifies its position on the idea that it is smarter, more capable. It deserves to have more say. It deserves to have more income. And that's just all false. It's a function of the structure of work and of the economy. It's not a function of the genetic endowment of the people who are in the 20%. Any more than 50 years ago, the fact that white people felt that black people were in a subordinate position because of genetics. That was false. That's been shown to be false, of course. And there will come a time when it is just as obvious to people how atrocious that view is. It will be as obvious that the view that the coordinator class dominates 80% of the population is also atrocious. And one last comment on the question of gender relations, sexual relations, racial and ethnic relations, and so on. I also don't think those are manufactured by those at the top. They are exploited by those at the top. That's true. It's certainly. But I don't think they're manufactured. There is real basis for these dynamics. And the basis for the dynamics also has to be changed. So in the same way, as you would say, that private ownership of the means of production underlies the power of the 1%, and therefore we have to address it, and I agree with that completely. And the same way I would say that apportioning work in such a way that 20% of the population has all the empowering work and 80% has all the disempowering work, and that has to be addressed to deal with another class division. It also, it seems to me, is true that the way we have organized daily life, households, interactions between genders and regarding the upbringing of the next generation, and the way we have organized relations between communities, whether they be racial or ethnic or religious, has intrinsic to each very serious problems that have to be undone, overcome in a new social setting, in a new society, if we're to get rid of racism and sexism and heterosexism and so on. So I think all those things are real. I think they're all very important. I think they're part of a vision. I just was talking at the outset about economics.
I would view it a little bit differently once again. Certainly there is resentment by the working class of those elements that sit above it. You call it coordinator class. The managers, the professionals, those who are independently employed in doctors, lawyers, and so forth, there is certainly a resentment. But I think part of that resentment is because the 1% make sure that 10% is well taken care of. They make sure that, like the recent tax bill, independent employed businesses, not corporations, get big tax cuts. They make sure that the managers and the CEO are well compensated, managers all the way down the line. And in certain industries, let's say the tech industry, where the workers are more skilled and more important to the profits of those companies, they're paid fairly well. But that's a 10%. If you look at where the wage and income gains have gone, it's gone to that 10% or 5%. And of course, you get above 5%. You know, most of the 90% of the income is from financial assets, stocks, bonds, and so forth of those folks. But there's a layer of the coordinating class in between there. You know, socialists used to call it the petty bourgeois, the small capitalists, the independent capitalists, so forth. We don't refer to it in those terms anymore, but they are well taken care of. And I think that generates a lot of the resentment. And of course, those people are, their role is to coordinate, as you would say. The big capitalists don't get their hands dirty doing that. They have well-paid people who do that. But that does not mean that the main antagonism, in my view, is between that intermediary group, because the main antagonism, I think, is the decline of the standard of living, not just economic, because with the economic decline, we see this terrible cultural decline in this country. You know, 50,000 people a year die from opioids, another 38,000 kill each other with guns, and another 40,000, maybe not quite that, maybe 20,000, commit suicide. So, you know, we got 100,000 people in this country a year who are killing and dying. I mean, that's two Vietnam Wars, a Vietnam War every 6 months, you know, and nothing's really being done about it. You can see the farce about the opioids going on and the control of the opioids in Congress. One final thing. I do relate to your emphasis on hopelessness, and that's got to be changed somehow. You know, 50, 60 million workers in this country are indentured to hopelessness. This is the precariat, as they call it now. You know, contingent labor, part-time, temp, independent, contract, people working two and three jobs, can't afford to start a family, can't afford to really have a home of their own, have to you know, room with four and five other people. This is, of course, where the interest in socialism is. But this hopelessness of 50, 60 million people, a third of the workforce or more, is really the indication of capitalist policies that are destroying workers who don't produce enough for them anymore. You know, we're moving into a period where it's those who are very highly skilled intellectual workers that are those who produce the value for the capitalists, and the rest of them can you know, go deliver pizzas and whatever, and no one cares. That's the hopelessness, the cultural decline I think socialism has to address and speak to, not just raising wages.
Okay. If socialism is, the capitalist is removed, the private ownership of production is eliminated, but 20% of the working population, let's call it, makes all the decisions, and by virtue of making the decisions, and by virtue of having a monopoly on empowering work, has the bargaining power to reward itself far more than the 80%. And when you say that the people I call the coordinator class are well taken care of by capitalists, I think that's missing the point. The people who are called the working class have the power, the bargaining power, to take more than capitalists want to give them, and so they do. But in any case, if the new system is like that, then like the Soviet Union, it'll be a system in which the daily life of working people in workplaces is very little different from the daily life of working people in workplaces in a capitalist economy. They will still be subordinate to the rule of others, the coordinator class. They will still have no say over what they're doing or how they're doing it. They will still have low income. Some things will be improved and other things will be worse. Some things about what was called socialism in the Soviet Union were better, and some things were worse. But what we won't have is an economy in which people control their own lives, and in which people, and by the vision of which people could be inspired. You know, when you say that the main antagonism is between workers and owners, a great many workers, and it should have been zero, right, voted for Donald Trump, a billionaire. That's not obvious how the class antagonism that you're talking about, which is real, right, between workers and owners, translates into that. The class antagonism that I'm talking about, a second one, easily translates into that because it was hatred for Clinton, not love of Trump. When I used to teach in prison for a while, and this first became, I first became sort of sensitized to this in a very significant way when I was teaching a course on capitalism, and I was talking about, rather like you, I was talking about the role of owners and the role of 1 or 2% of the population and their machinations and the way in which they run everything, including the prison system. And there was no passion in the room. It's not as if people were disagreeing with me. We're talking 50, 60 prisoners who were taking this course on capitalist economics. It wasn't as if they were disagreeing, but they weren't very passionate about it, which surprised me. And then I started talking about another set of people, doctors and lawyers and engineers, and the people in the room became passionate. They almost went berserk, talking about the hatred they feel for this sector of people who, by the way, they want their kids to become, a very vicious dynamic, but in any case, a sector of people who look down on them, who are paternalistic toward them, who boss them around, who take for granted their superiority. And it's that dynamic, that's the dynamic that makes so many people so fed up with what they call political correctness, because it's felt as just more of the intellectual elite, the empowered elite, defining our lives. So these issues are not sort of beside the point. They have a tremendous effect in the present on the attitudes of different people in society, on their class consciousness, which instead of being as we both might like it to be, totally focused on the owning class, on the capitalist class, and on combating it, instead of that being the only dynamic at work, there's this other dynamic. And this other dynamic is very, very powerful and affects people's hope, people's inclination to feel that there's any chance for anything better, people's cynicism, and on and on. And so I would, and it's not manufactured by the people at the top. The difference between somebody who's working on an assembly line and somebody who's governing the assembly line in the workplace is not unreal. It's real. It's a real difference. And the only way to overcome it is to reorganize the workplace so that we all have a role in the economy that's empowered and that allows us to participate in decisions that really is classless instead of 20% ruling 80%.
That's well, if I can jump in on that and reply, I would argue that it's really the 1%, the capitalist class, that determine the policies that determine the living standard decline and the cultural decline and so forth. It's not the coordinator class. The coordinator class, as you call it, is a useful buffer for the 1% to keep the working class fighting with the coordinator class, and not just that conflict. It's all the identity politics keep everybody fighting and resenting everybody else on issues that have nothing to do with your standard of living. And yes, it's difficult
Jack,
sometimes
we can't be
to
farther
people
apart.
See. to get people to see who's behind it. Who's the wizard behind the curtain pulling the levers, you know? And that's always a struggle to do that. But I think, although, you know, your focus on coordinators and working class is real, it's only part of the picture. And the bigger picture is to get people to see who's really behind it all.
In capitalism, the capitalists are at the top. We agree. In capitalism, the capitalists are ruling and are predominantly critical and culprits, I suppose you could say, in anything you want to point to regarding the society. That much we agree on. Okay? So there's no point. It's an open door to tell me we agree on that. What I'm saying is that there is another class, as you say, between capital and labor, and that that complicates greatly the situation that exists. And it makes it difficult to envision a good society from the point of view of working people, because from the point of view of the working class, a good economy is one in which they have power. And unless the 20% have a lot less power, then working people won't. That's one point. And about the identity politics thing, Jack, I'm sorry, but to say that the things, literally identity politics in its extreme form, I would probably agree with you about many elements of it being counterproductive. But to say that the things that is pointing out, the racial hierarchies, the gender hierarchies, the sexual hierarchies, for that matter, the political hierarchies, don't contribute to what makes people oppressed. I mean, I can't believe you said that. I can't believe you don't think that the racial hierarchies impact not only people's income, but their life circumstances, their possibilities, what their daily life is like.
No, let me clarify, Michael. You're absolutely right. No, I don't believe that it's irrelevant. And, of course, it does exist. And, racial and gender do oppress people. It's another level of oppression. But what I mean to say is that the capitalist parties and their paid-for politicians focus on and manipulate and use that to keep people divided on economic class issues. It's real, you know, gender and race is real, but it's used by the capitalist to fragment and destroy any kind of class economic focus in politics. That's the essence of what I'm saying. It's abused and used. And an important consequence of it being manipulated by capitalists and their political friends is that we have everybody fighting each other on these issues, and resentment by white workers against black and Latino workers, and males against females, and so forth. And that's been keeping us all divided on key economic issues. So it has to be both. It has to, we have to find a way not to let these identity politics issues destroy our focus on class and economic issues, which is doing. Yeah. We have to find a way to unite both and maintain both in any socialist movement.
That's true. It's definitely correct, and I agree with you, that one has to find a way to form a movement and to form movements which can challenge and can replace the causes of class hierarchy, and that means replacing private ownership of the means of production, but it also means replacing corporate division of labor and markets, and also replace racial hierarchy and gender hierarchy. And so when movements battle around trying to deal with racism and sexism, they aren't doing something that is counterproductive. They aren't doing something that is blocking, the real goal. They are doing something that is part of the real goal, and a critical part of the real goal.
Yes, so but the Democratic Party and people like that don't allow it to go any further. They use identity politics as a way of ignoring real economic class issues.
See,
Sanders being
way,
an exception, perhaps.
When you say it that way, Jack, it sounds like you're saying they use, that part's true, right? But they use these dynamics to prevent attention to real dynamics. And that's false. That's not just false. It really is a way of describing the world that is contributing to the problem that you want to overcome. That is, the racial problems that exist are real. They are just as real as economic problems. They are not peripheral, minor, secondary issues we can deal with sometime in the future. Same thing for gender. Same thing for sexuality. Same thing for issues of authoritarianism. They're real. They're part of the... So when you say we need movements that can deal with all of it in a combined way where the efforts of each contribute to the gains of the other, I agree with you. And when you and if you say that, well, the people at the top, at the very top, the 1%, don't want that and will try and obstruct that, I agree with you again. You know, absolutely. But that shouldn't cause us to fail to understand that these are real priority issues and that they all have to be dealt with. So that
I don't think I argued that, but you know, I'm trying to emphasize the reality of the present, where identity politics are being manipulated by the 1% and their political representatives as a way of keeping
solution?
Us fragmented and divided, and as a way of undermining the whole class issue,
Jack,
if you look at the income inequality going on and the collapse of the society and the culture going on, is today far more important. Yes, I would argue that far more important to a socialist movement, not abandoning those real identity issues, but we've pushed and we've allowed the 1% to push the pendulum into identity politics to obscure and obfuscate economic and material crises that exist.
Actually,
I really believe that's the case, and that's why I think we need to bring class back into the equation. And you know, that's okay. What Sanders and some of the others are doing. They're pushing back against that. And I also believe, you know, I think we have a difference here as well on the whole participatory economic thing. I think what we need in the present is a new political organization and that contends for the institutional levers of power. That's the first step. Longer down the road, we can talk about on the way down the road, we can talk about workers running their factories and their businesses. But I think right now, what they really want and really need is something to do about income inequality and hopeless jobs and lack of health care. Still, tens of millions of people and price gouging everywhere across the board by the capitalists. I believe that is priority right now.
The issue is, what does it take to win change? And the answer is, it takes a ton of people with all kinds of different priorities working together for a vision with a strategy. That much we probably agree on, right?
Yes. And what's the vision is important. I agree with you. What's the vision?
Okay. But when you say that sort of class has become lost, is not as prominent as it ought to be, I actually agree with that, right? Not that it should be more prominent than race and gender, but that it is lacking in prominence. But I'm going to tell you something controversial, which I think, about why that is. I think that a big part of the reason why our understanding of class has become sort of mechanical and not very compelling for people, whereas for some reason, this thing that you think is second, not primary, has become much more compelling to people, race, gender, huge movements organizing around them, is because class has been discussed in a way which doesn't really address what working people feel about the economy. When you say that the owners are horrible and the capitalists are horrible, okay, fine, and we can demonstrate that, and we can demonstrate all the damage that they do. But day to day, working people feel something else also. And when we are quiet about that, when we don't address that, they don't trust us. When we being anybody, when somebody is trying to talk to a working class audience and has time, so to speak, only for discussing the biggest owners and how bad they are, and doesn't have time for the fact that the working class is in part black and in part Latin and in part female, and doesn't have time for those issues, which are very real in the workplace as well as in communities, and doesn't have time to address the passion that workers feel about their subordination. They're being treated like children. They're being pushed around. If we're oblivious to that, then class becomes less important. It becomes important. It's important.
I absolutely agree with that point. Agree with that point. We have to stop talking about class like intellectuals having read books. We have to, and I think one reason I was successful as an organizer is because I would denigrate the owners and, in get the workers to believe and understand that they were better people than them. In other words, raise the dignity of yourself in relationship to the others. I think something like that is very important. How we talk about, I absolutely agree with you, how we talk about the owners, not simply because they own, but because these are lesser people, you know? These are people that screw everybody over, that even screw over their families and so forth, not like you do. You're taking care of your families. That's why you're trying to do this. That kind of psychological message has to be injected into the whole class debate. I agree with that.
Okay.
Anyway, we got about 1 minute. Would you like to go here? Would you like to tell where people can go and read more about your views on this particular
subject? One possibility is ZNet, the website, www.zcom.org. And another possibility is that I've begun a podcast. It's called Revolution Z. And you can, you know, if people are interested, they can look that up in all the places that podcasts appear, Stitcher and Apple Podcasts and so on. And also there are links for it on ZNet. So I guess, and, you know, there are many videos and debates and books about participatory economics, which we only, you know, just barely began to.
Yeah, it's a real deep subject here, and we could go on for a very long time. I've enjoyed the discussion with you. There's a lot I agree with you, and of course, you know, on this subject called socialism, there's a lot that socialists don't agree on with each other. Maybe that's part of the problem. I think hopefully we started a discussion here and maybe contributed just an iota to the debate going on now. What is socialism? How can we make it more relevant and more human here as an alternative to the existing economic problems and other problems, social cultural problems, which are overlaid on top of it in this country? Thank you, Michael. We'll do this
again. Thank you for having me.